Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and I'm waiting for Dennis Palumbo to call in to the show, and we're going to talk about his book, Head Wounds. So until he gets here, I'm going to define the word head wounds. As we know, when you get a concussion or a severe problem on your scalp or something like that, that knocks you out. If you've ever had that kind of a problem before, a head wound is in sort of an injury to your brain, skull, or scalp. It can range from mild bump or bruise that can cause a brain injury. And we're going to talk about his book, Head Wounds, in just a moment. And I'm just hoping that he gets here because the author has not called in yet, and that concerns me. So I have, you know, no idea if there's a problem or if he's having trouble getting in. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this book. Psychologist Daniel Rinaldi is in trouble because someone is trying to solve. Hold on a minute. Here he is.
Hello.
Hi, good morning. How are you? I got worried.
Fine. No, there's traffic in Los Angeles. No, I just got here.
Oh,
but
God,
I'm happy to be
worried
on the show.
Oh, good, because let me tell you, had some technical difficulties before, and I'm saying, oh, my God, don't tell me that he's having trouble getting in. The other
yeah,
day
actually,
I called about
2 minutes ago, and then it just cut me off, so I called again.
That's weird because I didn't see it come up on my screen. I'm going, oh, my God. Yeah, I have to email them because on Monday I was talking to Matt Coyle and my phone didn't like it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I have my cell phone next to me, so that's not going to happen.
No.
So we have psychologist Daniel Rinaldi, and he consults with the Pittsburgh Police Department, and he's being stalked by this crazy man who scared the daylights out of me, Sebastian Maddox. So I'm going to ask you to tell everybody, and I'm going to put my Facebook wall up in case anybody has any questions out there. When you created the storyline for this novel, how did you come up with the beginning with a dossier about Barbara's death? That was interesting. And that's
going
to set the stage for what's going to happen.
Yeah, I had in the book prior to Head Wounds called Phantom Limb, one of
mm-hmm.
the characters is a very wealthy woman who comes to see Daniel, and she has her security man do a dossier on Daniel Rinaldi and his life because she wanted to do some due diligence before she came to see him. And at the end of the book, the person who had put that dossier together says to Daniel, "I don't think your wife was killed accidentally in the mugging the way it looks.
Mm.
I think she was murdered." And so that sets up, it's the only cliffhanger I've ever done in the series. It sets up Head Wounds, which then begins with our hero, Daniel Rinaldi, looking through the dossier because the man who told him this dies. And so he has no idea what it was in the dossier that gave this security man the idea that his wife's death was not an accidental result of a mugging gone wrong, but actually a predetermined murder. The problem is the guy didn't tell Rinaldi what it was in the dossier that he found that gave him that indication. So the book begins with the psychologist, Daniel Rinaldi, my hero, constantly rereading the dossier and trying to figure out what's in there that would give him the clue. And at that point, the story goes off in a different direction, and as the reader soon learns the identity of the person who killed his wife and that the person is now on a mission of revenge against Daniel Rinaldi and anyone close to him. And his goal is to cause Daniel as much pain as possible by injuring or killing people close to him until finally he will have a mano meeting with Rinaldi himself. And I was driven to write this book because so many of my loyal readers of the series over the years have kept asking me, come on, what really happened to Rinaldi's wife? And I kept vamping because I didn't know. and then it finally occurred to me, and so once I knew what it was, I thought, okay, I'm going to do something different. In most of my mystery thrillers, even though they are psychological thrillers, and very suspenseful, they also are whodunits. You know, we don't know who the bad guy is till the end, and there's lots of twists and turns till we get there. In Head Wounds, I did something a little differently, in that the reader finds out 50 pages into the novel who the bad guy is. And instead, it becomes a very deadly cat-and-mouse game between my villain, Sebastian Maddox, and my hero, Daniel Rinaldi. I think it's one of the strongest entries in the series.
It is, and it scared the daylights out of me. I'm still getting nightmares about this guy. And, every time, you know, somebody bangs their head or something, I get like, oh, my God. If you've ever had a concussion, and I've had one a long time ago, this looked like hit the home. Oh, my God, you can really lose it. So we've got, I know. I have to tell you that I told about 5-6 people that I was interviewing you today and the book, and I've got hands out for this one. Let me tell you, they're going to have to buy it themselves. Forget it.
Yes.
It comes out on Tuesday. I'm not giving it away.
No. It comes out on Tuesday. And I have to tell you, I am absolutely I got really nice blurbs and reviews, but the one I liked the most was a mystery writer I really admire, Edgar-winning writer Thomas Perry. Mm-hmm. Was giving an interview about his best new reads, and he mentions Head Wounds and says that he is still haunted by the memory of the villain of that book. And that really meant a lot
review.
To me. That's a very
Wait
high review
mine
coming.
On Tuesday.
Yeah,
from
it comes
him,
out
yeah.
on Tuesday. Yeah.
Well, I've got my review in front of me.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And I made some analogies to some very famous people.
Well, that's very nice.
It took me a while. It took me a while, but I figured this one out.
Well, thank you. I hope it's a good one.
Well, you know, my reviews are good, I hope. I just finished, if anybody wants a pre-order besides Head Wounds, a million copies, it's coming out Tuesday also, A Death or My Vote by James Grappando. Oh, my God.
Another one?
That was it was better than anything he's written ever before.
Wow.
It's a Jack Switek book, but it's based on a young black kid, president of a fraternity that's killed. And they blame it on a white president of a fraternity and what happens between the two communities. It's scary. It's
wow.
really scary because this kid never did what he said. But anyway.
I'll have to put it on my to-be-read pile.
That and Skyjack by K.J. Howe, by Kim. I'm interviewing her, and she invited me to the Philofest, because they're wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, she's great. I've been to Thriller Fest. She's great.
Yeah, she is great, and her book is fantastic. So
good.
We have Joy and Eddie. And how does she wind up with a relationship with Daniel, and how does she rope him into becoming friends? She's not too bright, this one, seriously.
Well, for the, you know, your listeners may not know who we're talking about. I don't see why they would.
Yeah.
What happens in the beginning of the book is Daniel Rinaldi's neighbor across the street, whose name he doesn't even know. He's like many of us in the modern world, we don't know who our neighbors are. You know, we may see them once in a while, but we don't know who they are.
Yeah.
And anyway, all of a sudden, Daniel's going through the dossier, as I said, and all of a sudden a bullet comes through the window. And so he luckily survives and runs outside to see what's going on. And there's a man named Eddie Burke who's drunk and who's weaving back and forth in the middle of the street, firing off his gun and yelling for his girlfriend, Joy, to come out of her house.
Mm.
And what ends up happening is we learn, I mean, the police take him away without incident. What we learn is that Eddie and Joy, you know, live together, and she's a beautiful young woman, an heiress, and she and he fight all the time, and he's always accusing her of having an affair. And so when he starts waving a gun around, he kept saying, "Who is it? Who is it?" And she just says, "It's Daniel Rinaldi, the guy across the street." She just picked him out of a hat because she had seen him so many times. And as she says, "Well, you know, you're not bad looking, and you're nearby." And so, you know, the police and everyone believe that they're having an affair. And Daniel says, "I didn't even know her name until 5 minutes ago." And she confesses to the police, "No, I just said his name. You know, it popped into my head because a guy was waving a gun at me." And what ends up happening is poor Joy is later raped and killed. And the police assume that her boyfriend Eddie did it. And they start looking for him, but our hero is not convinced that that's the whole story. And as is often the case with an amateur sleuth like Daniel Rinaldi, he's right and the police are wrong.
I know,
and
that's scary.
Yeah, it's pretty, I would say it's pretty intense. Joseph Fiender said it was the most vivid and harrowing book he'd read in a long, long time. So I really wanted to push my hero to his limits. You know, I really
everybody.
Did. I wanted the reader to have the same experience of paranoia and dread that our hero does.
Some of those scenes, like I said, gave me nightmares, and they still do.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I don't want to give people nightmares. I just want them to get a nice, happy scare.
They will. Terrified. And they'll think twice before becoming anything close to this guy. For real. So when the police question him, her, and then him, and then they drag Daniel into it, what is her motive and what happens when Harry Poe questions her and Daniel? And it doesn't look too good.
No, it doesn't, because the police are a little suspicious when both Daniel denies any relationship with her and she says, oh, I just made that up. And then later when Eddie Burke is found dead, you know, he had been their number one suspect. So then the police turn around and go, well, you know, her murder was so artfully done and no prints or anything. You know, it was very, very well done. We don't think it's Eddie. We think it's you, Daniel. And that, so, you know, of course, Daniel has to try to prove that he's innocent. And it's very difficult for him because he actually knows who the killer is. The killer has announced himself, but said, if you say anything to the police, I'm going to start arbitrarily killing people in the city. And so Daniel and two friends who he's working with, a retired FBI profiler named Lyle Barnes and a woman named Special Agent Gloria Reese from the FBI, they're the only three people who know who the bad guy is and have been sworn to secrecy about it because he's blackmailing them and saying, if you say anything to the police or anything or anybody or to the news, I'm going to just indiscriminately start picking targets. And that's what I think contributes to the suspense of the book is that, you know, these four people, my hero, his two friends, and the villain, Sebastian Maddox, are locked in this battle that the rest of the city doesn't know anything about. And it's so clandestine that I think that contributes to the paranoia and dread in the book.
It does, and I wondered sometimes, because I've been reading so many books that where people know things and nobody knows that they know it and how they find out, that it's really scary that this guy knows exactly what he's doing. That's what's scary.
Because he's a
technology.
I did a little research on this, and you know, he, because he's a computer expert, the villain, he can hack into computers. You know, or, as I mentioned in the book, the head of both the CIA and the FBI put duct tape over the little cameras on their laptops because they know they can be, it's called botting, they can be botted robotically from a long distance and turn on the camera and see you without your awareness of it. And in fact, there's something that Sebastian Maddox does when he's in prison before he gets out and starts his rampage. If you recall, the prison warden and the police find out that because he had been working in the electronics shop in the prison, he had built his own computer and had gone online and begun hacking into people's credit card information and banking information. This is based on a real guy who did this. And who actually hid the computer that he built up in the ceiling of his cell. And he had a whole network of Confederates, and he was running from his prison cell a giant computer software and credit card scam. And when I read that, I went, oh, my God, that's exactly what my guy would do in prison. And one of the things that a number of reviewers have commented on, it makes you feel like you want to change all the security codes on your computer.
I did right after the show.
Yeah, he hacks into
I
people's
cells. I did right
cells.
After I read it.
Yeah. And one of my favorite moments is when my hero gets in his car and Sebastian Maddox has hacked into his GPS, what do you call those little maps, and directs him, but uses that same woman's voice, you know, that now make a left at the next light. But it's the bad guy doing it, and it's really fun. I mean, I really enjoy that. And again, based on real material, one of the FBI's biggest concerns now is that hackers will get into the air traffic control system and fly planes where they're not supposed to go, doing it at a distance. And
that's what's
I read that. Yeah, I said, okay, I'm going to do it with a car. Yeah.
I think I'll stay on the ground.
Yeah, me too. But I think it's important for the reader. Yeah, I think it's important for the reader to know that everything my villain does here is actually real. You know, it's not like I made up any sci-fi kind of thing. Everything he does in terms of the computer, the internet, hacking into people's cell phones, it's all based on truth.
Well, you need to read Guilty Blood by Rick Acker, who is a supervising deputy attorney general of California. I interviewed him on Friday for Guilty Blood, and it's about this, based on his son who's autistic, who is able to hack into the DNA CODIS system because somebody changed this kid's DNA and he was convicted of murder.
Oh, my God.
That was
a great story,
I've been a
victim. I'm learning about a lot of
this
interview
teaching
me a lot about other books.
This is what happens when a book winds up in your mailbox and you don't know you're getting it.
That's the time, I
don't even know. Yeah, that's how I got the Grapando book. She just sent it, and I just read it, sat down. So after dealing with this, we have Lieutenant Beagler, and who thinks that, you know, after dealing with this incident, why does he go over to her house? And he and Polk find her, and what do they think that, you know, that Lieutenant Beagler thinks that he's the killer? I mean, I don't know why he decided to go over there, because he felt bad for her, but still.
Yeah, I know. He decides to go over there afterwards because he's coming out to go to work in the morning and he sees her front door is open, banging in the wind.
Yeah.
And he goes, something's wrong, and he runs over. The reason the police suspect him is because the Sebastian Maddox, who had done the actual murder, there were no fingerprints, there was no fiber, hair, any DNA, and her boyfriend, Eddie, the guy that had been drunk and weaving in the street, they just didn't see him as someone who would so meticulously plan something like this. Because he had, you know, been taken away by the cops after shooting up the street and then had stolen his own lawyer's car and driven back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's such a spur-of-the-moment thing. He's not going to come with bleach and white gloves and rubber gloves, all the stuff that our villain actually used. So they said a guy who would be that smart who's involved in this is Daniel Rinaldi. So that's why they suspect him. But even Sergeant Polk, the police sergeant with whom Daniel has a kind of grudging relationship, even Sergeant Polk thinks his boss, Lieutenant Beagler, is clutching at straws. Beagler has never liked Daniel Rinaldi in all five books.
Yeah.
It's made very clear because, you know, Daniel's a civilian. He's a civilian consultant to the police.
Mm-hmm.
And
they don't want to get rid of him.
Yeah, most of the department doesn't like him. And he's become a little bit of a media darling. Daniel is always presented as like a talking head on CNN and stuff like that. And and so the police really think he's a little bit of a showboater. And so they're not too happy being forced to deal with this guy, but he helps them a number of times. And his job, his official job, is he's a consultant with the police because he's an expert on trauma. And his job with them is to treat the victims of violent crime, people who maybe survived a kidnapping or a home invasion or a sexual assault. And one of the things that I wanted to do in the books, in all the books, the whole series, all five of them, is most of the time in crime thrillers, the victim is just a chess piece. They go, oh, yeah, you know, Bob Smith got killed. Let's find out who killed Bob. Not often enough is the effect of this crime on the victim and the victim's family and friends, which mm-hmm. is a crucial aspect. And so I wanted to make sure that the crime victims take front and center in all of my stories, because their story and their trauma in the aftermath, I mean, if you think of some of the mass shootings we've had, we talk about yeah. the victims who were killed, and we talk about the shooter. What about someone who just shot in the arm but was next to three people who got killed? That person mm-hmm. is going to be traumatized for months and months and months, and usually needs treatment. And so, you know, whenever someone has been kidnapped and then they're found again and everyone goes, oh, isn't that great, and the story's over, but not for the kidnapped victim. That person is going to have recurring nightmares. They're going to have most of the symptoms, usually, that we associate with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and very vigilant about potential future dangers. Also, if you're someone in a mass shooting, for example, and you get shot in the leg and the three people around you get killed, you also are going to struggle with survivor guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, struggled with for years, because when he and his wife were mugged and she was killed, he was shot, but he survived. And he's felt guilty ever since for having survived that encounter, which is one of the things that motivates his mission to help other victims of violent crime.
Now, I know what you're saying. I was in a car accident when I was 17. I was sitting in the back in the middle, and it was really weird because my mother's friend, we were going shopping, always picking up stuff for my mom. Everybody was doing something for somebody else. And my mom's friend decided to come at the last minute, and it was really weird. We had a head-on collision, and I couldn't tell you how it happened. We were going in one direction. They were coming. This girl came, and she went right into us, and it was horrible. And I felt bad, because my mother had said to me, why don't you ask her to come? And I said, well, maybe she doesn't want to, and at the last minute she decided to come. So you feel, yeah, that, oh, my God, maybe if they didn't ask, you know, her to come, she would still be here. But then I might have been sitting in the front seat,
That's
in the passenger
right.
seat.
So you understand
you don't
about,
know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you never know. So that the things that I like about my mystery series, I know this sounds, you know, clapping myself on the back here, but I like that I get to talk about victims of violent crime, but I also
yeah.
like that I get to talk about the mental health system, and because the stories are told in the first person, the reader gets an experience mm-hmm. of what it's like to be a therapist, to deal with patients. And lastly, the thing I like is I get to write about Pittsburgh. The books take place in Pittsburgh, which is a very fascinating character in and of itself. You know, when I grew up in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. it was all steel mills and smoky skies, a very blue-collar industrial town. Well, as you know, Pittsburgh's undergone a complete transformation, and it's now kind of a high-tech, white-collar town, and there are no more mm-hmm. steel mills. I mean, when I was in college, I worked my way through Pitt by working in J&L Steel, which was a steel mill on 2nd Avenue. That's gone now. And now it's been replaced by a bunch of gentrified she shopping malls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that I like about my lead character is he has a foot in both worlds. He was born in a blue-collar world, but he was also the first in his family to go to college, to get an advanced degree, to wear a jacket and tie, and be a professional, to be a white-collar mm-hmm. professional. And in Pittsburgh to this day, there's still a very uneasy tension between the older people who've lived in the same neighborhood and whose blue-collar jobs were the same jobs mm. their parents had and their grandparents had. Those jobs are gone, as anyone in Pennsylvania will tell you. And so it's really changed the dynamic of the city. The city is terrific. It's an amazing city and always voted the best city to live in because of some of these changes. But it's had an effect on longtime residents of the place because it's really changed a lot. And so that tension is one of the backgrounds against which my stories take place.
Yeah, that's what makes it so realistic. And my niece wants to follow in your footsteps and be a psychotherapist.
Oh, she does, huh? My condolences.
She does, and I told her about you, and she's got a 3.8 GPA, and she's 15. She's going to be 16 in 2 months, and she follows her aunt's brilliance, I told her. And Harvard and Yale have already asked for her, and Villanova, too. And we're thinking about other places. She was thinking about Pittsburgh, actually, and Penn State. So I said to her, before you choose anything, you talk to me, and I would talk to you and a few other people, because we have to make sure that the university is safe and it has what she wants, and she's a trip.
Well, yeah. Please let her know she can call me or email me at any time. I've been a therapist in private practice for 28 years, so I pretty much know the biz inside and out. So I'll be perfectly happy to talk to her.
I told her that. I saw her 2 weeks ago when she came into New York. It was so cool talking to her. You know, I felt like, oh, my God, finally one of my nieces that is going to, she's going to go places. So this killer, Sebastian Maddox, he's scary. He knows what everybody's doing. He knows what Daniel and Burke and Reese are doing. And then he decides to pick his victim. Why did he pick Stephen Langley? And how did he kill him right in front of his eyes? Oh, my God, that was like, ugh.
Yeah, well, he remember, his goal is to cause Daniel as much pain as possible. And so he hacks into the traffic cameras that the city of Pittsburgh has. So we see all of a sudden on the video screen, I mean on the Daniel's laptop screen, the video live streaming footage from the traffic camera. And we see this old man standing at a bus stop waiting for a bus. And Daniel doesn't even recognize him at first. And that's when Sebastian Maddox says, this was your first patient. A guy named Stephen Langley. He's a grandfather now, if you want to update your records. But he was your first patient. And then, as you mentioned, Sebastian Maddox kills him. And we see it right on the screen. He hits. It's a hit and run. And then what, because Sebastian Maddox, like a lot of people who are delusional, and he is delusional, he has a condition called erotomania. And because he's delusional, I worked in a psychiatric hospital for 3 years in my internship.
Mm.
And what often happens with delusional people is they decide that there's a mechanism or a pattern that sort of affirms or ordains their behavior. And so for Sebastian Maddox, it's symmetry. So if he's killed the first patient Daniel has seen, the next person he's going to try to kill would be Daniel's newest patient. And in the book, as you remember, his newest patient's a 12-year-old boy. And luckily, I'm not ever going to kill a kid in a book, so luckily he gets rescued. But the point is that it's that symmetry that works for Sebastian Maddox. So if he's going to kill Daniel's first patient, next he's going to kill his newest patient. You know, and this is the only way that Daniel Rinaldi can kind of keep track of what this guy's doing, because he can begin to understand the role that symmetry as a pattern plays in regulating Maddox's behavior. And again, this is all material that is, you know, empirically based on, you know, what do you call it, clinical material. And one of the things that's most interesting about my villain is the erotomania. I don't know if your listeners know what that condition is, but erotomania is the delusion where you believe someone is in love with you. And no matter what they say, even if they say, no, I'm not, you have a whole set of delusions that convince you that they are. Like, you might decide that if they wear green, they're sending you a secret message that they love you. Or if they take off their glasses when they're yelling at you, it's a sign that they're not really mad. They're just putting on a show for everyone around them. You and they are secretly an item. And you cannot shake this delusion. For someone who has erotomania, it just stays there. And it takes years and years of therapy and usually a significant amount of psychotropic meds And the best you can hope for sometimes is that the person's delusion of an erotic love affair with you transfers to someone else. And so it's very, very powerful condition and quite alarming. I mean, you end up, you know, the person who struggles with the condition stalks their victim and leaves them notes.
Mm-hmm.
And not because they're trying to hurt them, but because they're trying to say, hey, you know, we're lovers. We're meant to be. You're my soulmate, which can be terrifying to the person on the other end of this.
It can be dangerous to them, too, if the person decides that they're rejecting them. They don't want that.
That's right, and that's what happens to Sebastian Maddox. When the object of obsession is Daniel's wife, and he goes to, after Sebastian comes out of prison for drug dealing, and he finds out that the love of his life has married Daniel Rinaldi. And so she has to be executed for her betrayal. And that really starts the wheels of the plot in motion. And so it's a very intense cat and mouse game between the two of them. And again, it's also fun for me to write characters that I've used before, particularly Lyle Barnes, the former FBI profiler. He was in the novel Night Terrors, and it was so popular with the readers, I thought, I got to figure out a way to bring him back. So I did.
I'm glad, because I remember all the... I read that one. I read Phantom Limb, and now I read this one. And nobody can hide from me, because if I see it on Facebook, I just say, where's my copy? It's so easy. Well, it was funny, because the other day I was looking, just to put you, which I did, I put your link to your book from Amazon on my Facebook wall. I didn't post a review. I'll post that on Tuesday with 27 stars. But so I put that on there, and all of a sudden I said, oh, my God, Philip Mulholland wrote Third Victim. And 5 seconds later I get an email from him. I'm sending you the book. When's my interview? And go, oh, okay. And it was, yeah. It's excellent.
They get,
March 1st.
Free books.
This is the good part about doing what I do, except for one author that I won't say. When I asked on Facebook, can I have a, would you like an interview with your co-author on my show, and would you like to send me the book? And somebody related to this person said, why don't you just buy it? I said, that's not how it works. When you're a reviewer, I was incensed.
Well, you should be incensed. That's outrageous, friend. My gosh. You're reading the book. You're publicizing it by discussing it with the author. Are you kidding?
And I wasn't. As a matter of fact, I had to be really careful because I watched my words. And I said, in case you don't know me, you can ask all these authors, and I listed them, if they don't know who I am. And I interview me. He said, well, if you really want the book that badly, I'm not going to tell the author to send it to you. You have to buy it. In which case, I said, whatever. I didn't even bother to answer.
I have a hunch that would have been a kind of snarky interview anyway.
Yeah, it wouldn't be worth it. And I have interviewed the author before with somebody else that the person wrote a book with. And I said, you know what? You're lost, because the book's not doing that well. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
So, Sebastian Maddox says, don't you dare tell the authorities, because he also threatened Burke and Reese. And how does he create, this was really cool. I mean, how is he able to make sure that their cells and laptop could not be shut off? I go like, oh, my God, that is scary.
Yeah, and it's also based in reality. That,
oh, God.
Really experienced hackers can turn your computer on and off, and can work on it while it's off. If you know, when you think, well, I've shut it off, or I've... One of the things that I like in the book is that often Daniel or Reese or Lyle Barnes will get so frustrated or so mad, they'll slam the lid of their laptop down, or they'll shut their cell off, and then it just brings it back on again. And even with the lid down, you hear his voice, you know, and it's... I check, this is all real. People who are experts at this do this stuff all the time. And I wanted to get that sense that he's everywhere. Like, one of the things that I also thought was kind of fun is that time when Daniel comes back to his car, he had put the laptop in his back seat. When he comes back to his car after a meeting, it's in the front seat with the lid up. which means that Sebastian Maddox had gotten into his car and moved the laptop from the back seat to the front. And now the screensaver picture is like an 8x10 headshot of Sebastian Maddox, because he said your screensaver was boring. So here's my fixture. You can have this on your laptop. And so whenever Daniel turns on, he's going to see Sebastian Maddox's face. I love this kind of omnipresent quality that Maddox has. A number of reviewers have said that's the thing that's the most frightening about the story, is you feel like he's always looking over your shoulder.
You know, he makes Jack the Ripper look very calm, to be very honest. And even the Son of Sam that was in my neighborhood when I grew up.
Gosh,
yeah.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, the Son of Sam went after girls with dark hair. And I had black hair at the time, and I made it blonde. I thought it was like a lot safer. And
I think
from what I gathered, he was right down, not too far from, killed somebody not too far from me in Pelham Parkway, and I go like, this is not good. And he was
well, you know,
a postal
very,
worker.
Very, is Sebastian Junger, the guy who wrote Perfect Storm, when he was a kid, mm-hmm. his family hired a handyman to work around the house, and it turned out to be Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler.
Mm.
And I mean, they didn't know that, of course, can you imagine? You look back and wait a minute. That was the Boston Strangler was fixing the door. That's hilarious, but creepy.
It's more than creepy. It's so showing up as a delivery guy, and then a valet, and anywhere. No one even noticed that he was there. I mean, this guy's like Harry Houdini. That's what I wrote in the thing. He's sort of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but more Mr. Hyde than Dr. Jekyll, this guy.
Yeah.
So,
well,
I
the
mean,
thing is,
that,
like,
and,
in the mugging, I mean, when you see a half dozen valets running back and forth bringing wealthy people's cars around, you don't look at their faces. You look, they're all wearing the little Toreador jackets and black pants and have keys in their hands running back and forth, and he blended right in. And,
well,
and
I have to tell you,
when
I
he
grew
delivers,
up in the South Bronx, so I noticed everything. Terrible.
Well, you know, maybe they're more paranoid in the Bronx than in Pittsburgh. But
yeah, we are.
Well, it's like when you have meds delivered from a pharmacy. The guy has the jacket on, the little pharmacy tag. You know, he has a pill bottle that has the right prescription on it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think twice. You just tip him and let him go. And that's one of the things that Sebastian Maddox does is he's able to blend in and disappear. And again, you get that sense where he's always two steps ahead of you. You know, my hero is so smart. I had to make sure that the villain was essentially smarter than him all the way up until my hero figures out a way to use the guy's delusion against him. And until that moment, you know, he's really two steps ahead of Daniel Rinaldi and Lyle Barnes and Gloria Reese, pretty much the whole book. And it's that thing where you start feeling, how's he going to stop this guy? Most mystery thrillers, we're pretty confident our hero is going to win because it's a series of books, and so it's logical he's going to win. What I wanted to do in Head Wounds that I don't see very often is the reader starts thinking about three quarters of the way through the book, how the hell is he going to stop this guy? He's outsmarting him.
I didn't think you were going to stop him.
Yeah.
I didn't think you were going to stop him. I had the feeling maybe you were going to keep him going.
Yeah, he could have been a long-term villain, but I think it was more emotionally powerful the way I ended the book. I just also felt it you couldn't make the reader go through this roller coaster and not have the catharsis of getting the bad guy at the end. I just think that would not work for me.
No, it's the way it's the way you got the bad guy that I applauded at the end of the book. I was like, is he really going to get this guy, or is this guy going to get them?
Yeah,
and I said, no, he can't kill off his main character because then he won't have another book for me to review, and then I'll be very sad. But, you know, you made a point about drugs and medicine and people just, you know, take them. I'm very funny about things. You know, you get a prescription that you've had all the time, you know, just a simple antibiotic or something. And I had this when I was taking care of my mom before she died, and there were certain blood pressure medicines that she had to take. So I went into the pharmacy one day, and I go, like, wait, these are not the same ones as they're supposed to be. This is supposed to be like a little horseshoe. Why are these circles? And I was right, because they were the wrong pills. They were the wrong ones.
Very good. I actually do the same thing. My wife's family is all medical, you know, doctors and nurses and stuff. So
yeah.
I've had it pounded into me that you look at every bottle when it comes, you read the label, you open it and take a look to make sure the pills look the same. Because people make mistakes. Human beings are flawed, and they make mistakes. So, yeah, and that kind of ease that we get into a kind of complacency about valets and people delivering meds and stuff like that. And we don't really pay attention to some of these sort of everyday people that we interact with. G.K. Chesterton wrote a wonderful short story about the killer that was a mailman, a mail carrier can almost seem invisible. So that when people said, was there anybody on the street, a lot of witnesses would go, no, because they didn't even register the mail carrier going from house to house. And so there are a lot of fun things you can do with a suspense thriller based on people's complacency about so many of the conventional things in everyday life.
I agree with you. You know, growing up in the Bronx, you have to be more alert, especially the South Bronx like I did. And when I was younger, it was okay, but when I was getting older and before we moved, it was getting kind of dangerous. So even though I live in a better area, if somebody's walking behind me, I let them go in front of me. I see somebody on a shadow on the side, I let them walk. Be my guest. Go ahead. No problem. And even with pills, I mean, if it's an antibiotic that was once white and they hand it to me and it's green, I want to know why. And if it's wrong, you better fix it. I won't take it. I would rather go back to the – I don't get anything delivered like that. I go to the pharmacy and get it. And I'll say, like, are you sure this is – what are the side effects? What does it interact with? I'm terrible. I drive them crazy. But you know what? It's worth it. So,
no, it is. And in terms of the digital world in which we live, one of the things I hope readers of my books, particularly Head Wounds, come away with is check your passwords, change them all the time, make sure you have a good online security, you know, whether it's Norton or Kaspersky or whatever. But the really, really heavy-duty guys can breach all of that stuff. But it's very unlikely that your average, you know, user of the Internet is going to have a Sebastian Maddox coming after them, you know. So the book gives you lots of thrills and chills. I agree. But I also think a lot of people have told me how emotionally compelling the books are because we care about these people that Sebastian Maddox is going after. Again, one of the things I've always tried to do in my series is make the victims human beings, people that we can relate to and care about. So we're really worried about them. They're not just chess pieces in a puzzle that our hero, the genius, gets to solve. And, in fact, the psychological effect of Sebastian Maddox on Daniel is one of the themes of the book. I mean, he's making Daniel Rinaldi crazy and makes him feel powerless and frustrated. And we don't usually see series heroes as in such a vulnerable place as I make Daniel. I don't know if you would agree.
All I know is that I cried at the end of every murder.
Yeah,
and as I read about Barbara, his wife, I was like, every time I read something about her, I was saying, oh God, maybe she'll come back to life, maybe she's really not dead, and that bothered me too.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing is I made her a real as real as I could make her, and so that
I felt like she was there.
You know, a sense of her marriage to Daniel. You know, and even though the series begins with the first book, Mirror Image, and she's already been dead for 10 years. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do this story, I'm going to link it to the mugging where she dies. I have to make her a palpable person for the reader. They have to feel really terrible. And so that's why I have her, you know, her notebooks from when she was in class and everything.
Mm.
So she becomes so real that her death really hurts us and bothers us. And also it brings back for Daniel Rinaldi, you know, he spent years trying to get over his survivor guilt. And he's even had, you know, relationships with other women in the books. And this brings his marriage and everything about it all back again, all the stuff he thought he had worked through. And so even though I like writing suspenseful books, and God knows this is the most suspenseful in the series, I think, it's mm-hmm. the emotional content, the characters, and the dialogue that actually inspire me. I mean, one of my favorite thing in all the books is my hero's relationship with his best friend, the Noah Fry, who's a paranoid schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And Noah's function is like of what the indigenous peoples call crazy wisdom. Even though he is psychotic, his psychosis and, you know, his hallucinations and delusions are kept in control by meds. And so, as he often says, I'm crazy but not stupid. And so he's often sort of a Greek chorus for the reader, the voice of a kind of crazy wisdom about the human condition. And his conversations with Daniel at the bar that Noah runs is one of my favorite strings throughout all mm-hmm. the book, is when the two of them are just having an Iron City beer and talking about life. It's my favorite stuff to write, practically.
Well, nobody realized that there was something that was wrong with Noah either, that he was getting the wrong medication. So
that's
that
right.
Made it even more true to life. But before
well,
I forget...
I worked, as I said, in a psychiatric hospital, and with schizophrenics,
yeah.
Even when they're on their meds, there's a certain glint in their eyes, you know.
Mm.
And it's very hard to tell when someone's reduced their medication. After a couple days, you can tell, certainly, but not initially. And then after a couple days, you start noticing their self-care is going down, their word salad is going up. Their motor control is changing a little bit, the autonomic control. So, you know, his girlfriend notices things are changing about him, but in a matter of a couple days, if he's off his meds, which is what Sebastian Maddox did, he gave him the wrong meds, he's
yeah.
moving right back into his delusion. And in Noah's case, unfortunately, it's persecutory delusions, which is very common in schizophrenia. So...
This is scary. This is so
yeah.
scary. I mean, I've always found these particular mental illnesses exciting, you know, interesting. I've taught for so many years, and I had a few students that were not schizophrenic but bipolar. And
oh yeah, and you know there is a category ESM with mixed psychotic features. So you can be bipolar, and in a manic phase, you're almost
mm-hmm.
delusional. You know, because if you're in
yeah.
a manic thing, I'm going to build my own rocket ship to the moon. Is that mania or is that delusion? It's a little bit of both. And so it's hard necessarily to parse out the differential, you know.
It was scary because it was a second grade little girl, and I was the dean, and they would call me because she was hiding under her chair because she thought there was a ghost under there.
Yeah.
Or that
yeah.
someone was going to hurt her. And it took everything out of me to convince the mother, who was one of my students, that she needed help.
Yeah.
And that she needed to put her in some type of program to help her. Otherwise, she was going to live a life of horror. But before I forget, next Thursday, this should be interesting, it was drugs. We're going to have a show on opiates. Kate Genovese wrote a book about her son who died of an overdose. And hopefully she will do the show. She seems a little apprehensive, but she asked for the show with Michael Embry, who's a reporter, his main character's son, who lied about being on Percocet and all of those. And those are the one things that I'm going to do some more research on, because I really feel that doctors are prescribing too many opiates and too many pain medicines. And many times after I've had dental surgery, they prescribe Percocet, and I tell the pharmacist, you could put it back on the shelf because Fran's going to take Motrin. That's it. I don't believe in that.
Epidemic
yeah.
is by prescription meds prescribed by doctors. And the thing
yeah.
is, a lot of people are getting these meds not prescribed by neural pharmacologists or psychiatrists. They're getting them prescribed by their OBGYN, their dentist, their internist.
Yeah.
And so anyone with an MD can prescribe any drug. I mean, the fact is your dermatologist can prescribe Haldol for you, which is an antipsychotic. And so
it hits me
that a lot of these MDs who had maybe 6 weeks psych rotation way back in med school later are prescribing psychotropic meds for their patients, and I just think that's an outrage. And so, in fact, I mentioned that in the books. I just think that's an outrage. And so the opiate epidemic is driven by the prescription drugs and Big Pharma, which I think has a big responsibility in this case. So I'm really glad you're doing that show.
Well, you're welcome to come on it. I want somebody that knows. I mean, to be very honest, I'm doing it because when I was in the hospital and I had surgery last year, my gallbladder didn't love me anymore. And
yeah.
I'm glad it's gone. This way we don't have to argue. And it was no big deal. I had the surgery on a Monday, and I was out to the beauty parlor on Tuesday because I don't believe in pampering myself, and it was no big deal. And they gave me prescriptions for Percocet, Vicodin, oxycodone, and fentanyl. And
there
I said, you may take
three.
Them. And I ripped them up. I ripped
you
them
got
up
the
right in front of them.
That's the trifecta of opiate drugs. Perfect.
Yeah, I ripped them up, and I said, I'll take Tylenol. I'm not taking any of this stuff. And after the surgery, they wanted to give me morphine, and I said, never, never. If you've never taken any, if you've ever taken that, I had surgery for something else, and all of a sudden, the nurse put something in my IV, and it was morphine, and I said, it's making me really weird, and take the thing out of my arm. I don't want it. And never. I mean, like I said, the strongest thing I'll take is Motrin, and if the pain doesn't go away, ice pack. I would rather be healthy than sorry. So I have a few more questions because we have a little bit more time. Yeah, this is a big deal for me. So we have Liz Cortland tells him more about Maddox, and she hands him a book that his wife was going to publish. How come she waited so long to give it to him? That was really interesting.
Well, yeah, as I explain in the book, you know, my hero meets Liz Cortland, who was a colleague of his wife, who taught at Pitt, and she gives Daniel, all these years later, an unfinished manuscript that Daniel's wife Barbara had been working on at the time of her death, and Daniel didn't even know she had been working on the book because Barbara wanted to surprise him and give him the manuscript because it's dedicated to him. And the way Liz describes it, Liz Cortland, is because Daniel does say to her, why didn't you give it to me right after Barbara was killed 12 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
She says, well, the timing never felt right. I figured you were dealing, you know, because he was in the hospital almost dying himself. And then she said enough time had gone by that it then felt kind of funny to give it to him. So then when she had met him at a party, as I describe in the book, she thought, well, maybe that's an omen. Maybe it's time to give him the manuscript. And again, it was to help the reader see who Barbara was. And, of course, it also reawakens Daniel's guilt because at first he's really mad and kind of offended that Barbara hadn't even told him about the book. And then Liz Cortland says, yeah, but look at the dedication page. And it says, you know, to Daniel, my love, my partner, you know, this is for you or whatever. And then he feels mortified for having been so self-righteous. And, you know, so it allows us entry into his own emotions and his back and forth guilt and frustration about this woman he was married to. And it just makes her so real. And so it's wonderful then because he's finally going to get a chance to meet her again when he starts reading her manuscript. So I think it's a very moving part of the book.
I think he gets to know her again in a different way. That's how it
tried
seems.
To do was make it so that we see that Daniel Rinaldi gets to know not only the wife he knew, but somewhat something about the wife he didn't know. And
yeah, exactly.
He was like before she met him. So, you know, she dated Sebastian Maddox, which is a real hammer blow, you know, so, but all before Daniel and she even met. So it has all these layers that I find so fascinating. So it's not just a thriller. It's kind of an emotionally, it has gravitas, I guess is what I would say. I don't want to beat my own drum here much, though I've been doing it quite successfully. But it has a certain gravitas that I like. For being a suspense thriller. It's both what they call a beach read, but at the same time, I like something that Kirkus Review said, that my books are for people who read late into the night and have no pressing engagements early the next morning.
You can't
ask for better than that.
I read that. Which you read my review?
I do want to mention to your listeners, because I always forget, that they can learn about all of my books on my website, which is the cleverly named DennisPalumbo.com. And if you go to the website, you can read the reviews of all the books, all five of them, including Head Wounds, which is coming out this Tuesday.
That's what I was just going to ask you. And the final question is, what's next for my character? What are you going to do to Daniel next?
I don't know. I'm so emotionally exhausted from writing this book. I haven't. I think Daniel wants me to leave him alone. I mean, to be honest with you, I think Rinaldi's there. Don't ask him for that. I've been through enough with this guy. Let me have some peace. So I don't know what's going to happen to Daniel Rinaldi next time. But I do know right now he's getting a well-deserved vacation. He should be in some spa somewhere, I think.
You going to hook him up with Gloria?
Well, they actually have hooked up. I don't know how long-term the hookup is going to be. I haven't figured out even what he's going to do about his old girlfriend, Eleanor. So they're in a little bit of a love triangle, and, you know,
I remember that.
Yeah, I don't exactly know what's going to happen when Eleanor comes back in the scene. But, yeah, I liked writing the hookup stuff with him and Gloria Reese. I thought that was kind of fun.
It was, but
and,
I think that what's going to happen is his wife is going to come in the spirit and tell him which one to pick, or don't you dare because I'm coming back. You never know.
Maybe that's right. Maybe the ghost of Barbara will come back and go, I don't like this Eleanor lady, but I like this Gloria one. I don't know. I actually don't know what's going to happen next, which is one of the fun things about writing these books. It's hard to believe, but when I start one of these things, I never exactly know what's going to happen. I like the book to tell me what it wants to be. And that's why I get to be as surprised as the reader.
I was surprised at this one, but before I forget, the 13th, I've got The Shepherd's Calculus by C.F. Farrell. On the 15th, this was unique. I didn't know what I was reading when they sent it to me because Partners in Crime, I do all their book tours and everything. And for that, they gave my book tour, and they were really nice about it. No Fury Like That is about a young girl that goes to purgatory because she needs to learn her lesson, and she doesn't realize, you know, yeah, it was interesting. It was like, oh, my God. The 21st, I don't normally do poem books, but Sherry Rosen is a great publicist. And The Book of Lovers by Bruno Ribeiro was interesting. It's almost like a Romeo and Juliet star-crossed lovers. That's all I'll say about that. On the 26th, the one and only Vincent Zandri, The Detonator. That was really an explosive novel. And to end off February, what better than The Voice Inside by Brian Freeman? And on March 1st, the one and only Philip Margolin, The Third Victim. I finished that today. It took me from yesterday to today to read it. I just sort of took my time. Usually, your books take me 2 hours, and I'm done, and then I read it again to make sure that I got it right. So I want to thank you so much. Are you coming to the Thriller Fest, I hope, this year?
To the Thriller Fest? No, I won't be at Thriller Fest. I'm doing a few other things, but my schedule, you know, I am a full-time therapist, and I can only duck out on my patients a few times. I don't feel book promotion is a legitimate reason to not see my patients. I see 40 people a week. In fact, I'm going to see someone in about 3 minutes. And
I'm going to the dentist in 3 minutes. I'd rather see the patient than the 3 minutes of the dentist.
So I really, to be quite honest with you, I do a limited amount of publicity for my novels, my mystery novels, because I am a full-time psychotherapist with patients to whom I feel a real clinical obligation. So If there's something near Los Angeles, you know, like I'm going to go to the Poison Pen bookstore and sign on Saturday, February 24th. But see, I'll fly in Saturday morning. I'll fly out Saturday night. So it doesn't affect my practice. So I tend to do that kind of thing where I can sort of sneak in and out on the weekend and not affect my practice. I want to.
You're a rare person, let me tell you. You're a rare person because you know how many doctors don't care about anything and then they'll just cancel? I felt bad on Monday because I had to cancel my show because I wasn't feeling great. And Matt Coyle was really quite understanding about the fact that I couldn't do the show for whatever reason. And Blood Truth is really
good. He's a
great
guy.
But get yourself 1,000 copies. Yeah, he really understood, guess why I had to cancel it. But it's a problem that's, you know, it's one of those things that you have that they can't cure, but it's not fatal. It's just annoying.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and when this happens, whatever, I said, you know what, I can't do a show unless I'm A1 perfect because I could hear my mother in her face. But I do want to say that I was very excited that in December my book, A Daughter's Promise, which is based on my mother's voice and my voice because she had Alzheimer's, won Cover of the Year for 2017.
Congratulations.
First time I never won anything in my life. And I said, Forward Reviews took it as one of their books, but I don't know if I'm going to win. It's up for Book of the Year for 2017 memoir, but I don't know how many others they're reading. But the fact that they accepted it and they're reading it, maybe I'll get honorable mention, and that would be a big deal for me coming from Forward Reviews because I have a lot of respect for what they do. So thank you a million times.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I was just going to sign off because my patient's here. But I wanted to thank you for having me on the show, Fran.
Thank you. Anytime, Dennis, and anytime you want to talk about any general topic other than books, just let me know. I talk about everything. Everybody?
All right, well, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.